Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari, Season 1, Episode 27. Hi, I'm Randy Cantrell. Welcome to the Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari. This podcast is based on a simple truth. Who you surround yourself with matters. Author and keynote speaker Leo Battari will interview thought leaders from all walks of life who will share how they leverage peer advantage and show you how engaging your peers more purposefully can hold the key to greater success in business and in life. Today's guest is Angela Myers. Angela is the founder of Choose to Matter, a global movement that challenges and inspires students to work collaboratively to develop innovative solutions to social problems. She's also authored 6 books, including Classroom Habitudes and The Passion-Driven Classroom, which introduced the concept of genius hour in education. Her You Matter talk at TEDx Des Moines in June of 2011 has been viewed several hundred thousand times and was the impetus for Choose to Matter. Angela's powerful message and down-to-earth style has made her a highly sought-after keynote speaker for education conferences, corporate events, and innovation summits. We welcome Angela to the show.
Angela Myers, welcome. So happy to have you here in Year of the Peer.
Leo, it is an honor to be here, and I'm saying hello to your whole community. You're a rock star in my book. I adore your work, and I'm so excited to be here to learn more about your community and to be in the presence of your genius.
Well, thank you so much. And I have to tell you, your work is so exciting and is so timely right now as we are entering into the second half of the Year of the Peer. And what I love really about what you're talking about is it isn't just about who you surround yourself with matters, right? And we know that for ourselves, but yet we as individuals matter a lot and we can matter a great deal. And that starts understanding that for the time we're little kids. I know you started out teaching kindergarten in first grade and have taught at every level from there. And so I'd love for you to talk about just that concept and let's just kind of go from there a little bit.
Absolutely. So I think, there's a lot of misunderstanding around the concept of mattering, that it is some sort of statement of inspiration. And I think in the beginning that that's an okay and an understandable assumption. I say to you, Leo, you matter. But you don't understand that I'm not saying that to you to inspire you, to be nice to you, to make friends with you. I'm saying that as a very staunch and urgent reminder that it is your moral obligation to own fully who you are. Not just for your own fulfillment and your own significance, but in a world where we are now dependent on who we surround ourselves with and how the people that we're surrounded with act and behave together as a unit, as a community, collectively, it is critical that we demand that of one another. I shared earlier a thing that I share with kids a lot is the fundamental truth that the smartest person in the room is the room. And that's a foreign concept, especially in an education system that's built on the smartest person in the room being the one at the front of the room or the highest on a pedestal in the front of the office. And that's fundamentally dangerous. It's not just false, it's dangerous. Because then you start, when you see somebody at the front of the room and you make the assumption, even if it's subconsciously, that they have something more than you, not different than you. Everyone has something different than you, but they don't have anything more than you or better than you. And so if you understand that whatever room you're in, beyond age, beyond grade, beyond any parameter, that every single human being has something to not just teach you or share with you, but has something to advance the room. And that's such a hugely different way of not only seeing learning, but seeing the world. And when you get that, everything in the world changes, because then it becomes a moral imperative for you to bring everything you have to that room, because you know other people are counting on it.
And yeah, it's incredible. And it's incredible what you say too about trying to own that, right? When you were talking, it reminded me of the scene in Good Will Hunting when you've got Matt Damon's character and Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon's talking about the fact that 20 years he's going to be working construction and they'll take the kids to Foley Field and all that. And Ben Affleck looks at him and says, if you're here in 20 years, I will kill you. You know, that because what he was basically saying, of course, to Matt Damon is you're not owning your genius. You're not owning the contribution that you can make to this world. And it's an insult to all of us if you do that. And he actually used that line. It's so interesting. And I don't think often enough that we either think about that ourselves or always surrounded by people who remind us of that, as in that case with the movie, right?
Absolutely. And I think that we have to remind each other, like I'll take you back to your five-year-old self. That's what this whole journey is, because being around five-year-olds isn't just something that's inspiring. It is something that reminds us of the deep biology that we were born with as human beings. So if you think about show and tell at five, you come and you've got this amazing thing in your backpack, right? And five-year-olds, when they walk in the door on show and tell day, they literally are like bursting. They want to burst. They cannot wait to share with you what's in their backpack. And then you make them wait. That's why you have show and tell in the morning, because they'll just blow up if you don't. And you've got 30 people that you have about 6 to 11 seconds to wow with what's in your backpack, right? And so you think this is a bragging circle. Like, oh, here's what's in my backpack. It's better than what's in yours. But five-year-olds intuitively know it's a fine balance. You've got to show up with the best thing of you in your backpack. But the whole purpose of that is so somebody will ask you at recess to tell you more. And if you brag, and if you're not humble about it, and if you don't do it by showing something that is of value because you listened to 29 other people and picked your item because it was unique or it serviced the 29 other people who shared, then you lose. You are alone with your backpack at recess. And that's describing 99% of the world and nearly every brand I know. We're so busy trying to brag about what's in our backpack or trying to get the biggest and best thing instead of figuring out how is what we put in our backpack going to be of service to the people who I care about most. And you cannot be of service unless you listen to them, unless you learn from them, unless you've honored them. So this is an exchange of honor. It's an exchange of respect at the deepest level between human beings, that you matter, that I matter, and that we can help each other, that something that you have, I may need, or I may know somebody who needs that. And never, ever underestimating that we have that incredible power with each other. And we've
such a great story. We had a guest just a few weeks ago, Ryan Foland, who talked about how entrepreneurs oftentimes, when they're asked to explain about what their company is about or what their product is, go into blah, 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 and they get into all this stuff and everyone gets completely lost, as opposed to saying, framing it in terms of, here's the problem we're trying to solve for.
Absolutely.
And says, wow, I've got that problem too. Now all of a sudden they're asking questions and engage in a conversation, and everybody's interested now, as opposed to getting talked at. You know, it's really, you know, essential piece of this. So I think what I struggle with sometimes, I think, and especially, you know, much has changed now too. We've got a lack of trust in institutions. We have a political environment that's very highly charged right now. And what I love in terms of looking at a lot of what you read is people not only are not listening to each other, they don't see each other in the way that you talk about it, in the way you describe it. And I'd like you to expand a little bit on this idea of how we can do a better job of just seeing one another, so then we can actually listen to one another and begin to understand one another in a way that can help us actually get things done.
Absolutely. So I want to answer that, but I want to build the context of the element of mattering. I used to think and kind of compare it to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but this isn't really a hierarchy. Mattering is an essential need. It is as critical to our wealth, our health, and our well-being as food, water, shelter, and air. We don't want to matter, we need it to matter. So the component parts of what we need to flourish as human beings is, as you said, to be seen. To really, really be seen. Because we look at people all the time, but very few people say that I've been seen by another person, that my presence has been acknowledged and admired and cherished. The next component of mattering would be to feel like we are heard, that we have something that not only we can say, because we have the privilege to say that, but that what we said and what we presented was valued by another person. And not only to know that what we have to say and who we are is valued, but the real level is knowing exactly what that value is. To be told explicitly, here's the value you have brought into my life, into my world. That ignites us from the inside out at the soul level, at the DNA level. But the deepest driver of human behavior and the third component part of mattering is to know that we are essential to someone else. Viktor Frankl wrote an entire book on man's search for meaning. It's what kept him alive. This is what keeps us literally alive, and being able to make it one more second, one more breath, is knowing that one other person is counting on us. It's what makes me jump up every day. Like, I'll never quit this mission, this movement, because there are people out there counting on me. And that forces you to do superhuman things. Not superhuman, but when someone else is counting on you, you find your superpowers really quick. So to be seen, to be heard, to be valued and know what that value is, and to understand your essentialness are all the component parts of what we now, we just announced it last week, we're actually creating an algorithm for this, your mattering quotient, your MQ. And so if you take the very basic building block of mattering, that first component, to be seen, it is profound how much just meeting the need of that component can change an entire interaction. It can change a mood instantaneously. It can change a mind. It can change a whole human. I'll give you just a quick example. I was at Walmart right before a trip, and I'm usually really conscious about being present with people, putting my phone down, being there, looking them in the eye, saying their name if at all possible. And at this particular day, I'm on my phone, and I set my phone down. The lady at the checkout, her name was Marjorie. I said, Marjorie, I just want to apologize to you. I was super busy. I just wanted to say, how's your day going? She just started crying, like just sobbing. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. She goes, I cannot believe you did that. And I thought she's mad because it was on my phone. She goes, I literally cannot believe you put your phone down and you said my name. I can't tell you the last time I've heard a customer say my name, look at me. And then she just started crying. She said, see those machines over there? That's how I feel. I do not even feel like a human being. People go through my line all day, 6 days a week. They do not look up. They do not acknowledge that I'm a human. And they walk on by. And I can't even tell you what that did. That's what being seen feels like to somebody. And I want to tell you that that reaction from Marjorie was just an unusual day and she was having a bad day. That is the reaction I get almost all the time. That is how desperate we are to be seen by other people. And it takes literally seconds out of a day to look someone in the eye, to say their name, to take a pause for 5 seconds, to say, I honor you when I'm in your presence. I'm going to listen to you. And what it does to a human being is profound. And it's also shocking that there's that kind of profound reaction, because this should be part of our standard operating procedure, and it's not.
Well, and I think the more that we are inclined to see people, the less we are inclined to jump to judgment about them.
100%.
You know, when you think about how there's so much about written about telling our story and how do we tell our story powerfully and effectively, and that's all well and good. But I also think about the flip side of the untold story. The yes. person that I meet, I have no idea what's gone on in their day, absolutely. In their life, in their week, you know, what that's about. And yet I will, and I've done it and we've all done it, you can kind of leap to a judgment about someone's yes. reaction in a particular moment that just is, you know, it's too bad that it happened, but it's entirely unfair to leap to anything right. beyond what happened in that moment. And
100%. And I'm guilty of it as well. We're human beings. We're guilty of it as well. I had a big conference that I was at, and the conference organizer, we had not seen each other. I usually try to do a Skype session with them to see their face so they know me, they know what they're getting into with me. And we just didn't have a great, it was in a different country, we didn't have a great, it was very formal. And so I met her, and it still, even the first interaction was not super. And then she came to my session, and she came up after the session, and she said, "I just want you to know that I haven't been owning my genius. I came from the corporate world. I'm actually an engineer, and I'm very, very passionate. This wasn't a job that I'm really good at, and I am changing the way that I'm going to be interacting with people now, and I just want you to know that I'm really grateful for you." And I'm like, I totally, she's painfully shy. She's in a new position. She's outside of her comfort zone. And I'm like, oh my God, I was jumping to conclusions thinking she's not a very, you know, I was making judgments. I was judging her. Yep. And I didn't take time myself to see her to find out what her story was. And some of the times we think that people are being rude or uppity, they could be painfully shy and you don't even know the difference. It's just so easy to jump to conclusions. And everybody does it, but it's just catching yourself in doing it.
Why do you think we operate with such triggers? Because generally speaking, you know, that's kind of what we're dealing with out there. It's people jumping. Yeah. It's the horrible situation that happened, of course, in Pennsylvania with road rage and the yes. young girl that was shot. Yeah. And you think about that level of people being amped up so quickly over things. And again, we have a society right now that has very difficult time engaging in real dialogue, engaging the ability to listen to one another. And here we are, you know, we're not even fighting anymore. Now we're not even fighting. Now no one wants to listen. No one wants to hear the other side. They don't want to know. And the unfortunate part of it is, not only in the political world, but I think in other aspects of our lives, it's holding us hostage. I mean, it is really putting us in a situation where we can't get anything done.
I totally agree with you. I think it's a difficult question. It's a beautiful, necessary, urgent question we should be asking. And the fix isn't simple. So I think when I look at mattering, when you look at mattering as an essential need, then you understand that you don't just stumble upon it. You don't accidentally decide to eat during the day. You don't accidentally decide that you need 7 hours of sleep or whatever it is. You build these essential needs into your routine. And when you're off your routine, you start making sacrifices in those essential needs. So when I'm traveling, I don't eat as well, or I don't work out as much, or I don't get as much sleep. It affects ultimately my behavior. I can go little ways. So part of the mission isn't just to spread the message of mattering, but part of my mission is to build the practice of mattering into individual routines and organizational routines. Because common sense, the things that we're talking about, are very common sense. Mm. Look people in the eye. I mean, how long have we been saying that? I mean, you go back to Dale Carnegie's foundational book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's all about mattering. The difference is there's so many other things that attract our day or our attention that we must be absolutely diligent and fierce about the routines. Turning this common sense into common practice takes a lot of focus and a lot of discipline. It doesn't take a lot of time. You can get mattering done, if you will, in a day. And I actually have a formula that seconds a day you can build these procedures in. But because I have a routine, I have rituals and practices that are embedded in my day, I fall back on those, that it becomes my default. So I was super stressed traveling. I was on the road for 3 weeks, and it can make a really happy person grumpy. So that's when you dig into your routine more. It's not when life is easy. It's when I feel myself getting grumpy or feel myself being overwhelmed. Then I'm more vigilant about my routine. I make sure that I put my phone away. I make sure that I see people, and because it changes me from the inside out. It's not so much about them. It changes me. I'm not eating right and working out or trying to keep the rest of my well-being in check for other people. I'm doing it because I cannot present to the world my best self without these rituals and routines. And I know I'm only hurting myself when I do that. But at least I know I'm not perfect, but I know when I'm getting off track. And so I prepare for that. So now I know that when I'm traveling and I'm going to be in a different city every day, I bring portable gym equipment in my bag. And it's not about being some fanatic and working out. It's knowing that when I work out, I'm a better human being. It means I bring like a sleep mask and earplugs, because I know when I sleep that I'm a much better human being when I sleep. So the same thing, I bring those practices everywhere with me, and they're not something that I am going to leave to chance and hope that it happens. They are a part of worthiness as a daily practice. and that's what it is mattering as a daily practice. And so that's part of why Genius Matters is so important, because I want to give people, kids and grown-ups, tools that they can use that are that they can, you know, make a part of their practice.
Well, and I want to talk about that book specifically, because you've written a number of books. And at the same time, when I think about Genius Matters, I not only find it very exciting because of the content, but I find it, I think the whole thing is a gift to the world. It really is. And I mean that very sincerely, because it is a gift from a content perspective, but it's also literally a gift in terms of the way you're distributing the book, which I think is so powerful and so meaningful. So I really would love for you to talk about both of those things, how it's being distributed and what it's all about for you, and why at this point Genius Matters mattered so much. And then of and to be thinking about the content as well, because I love, and I think, not to throw too much into one question, but I do want you also to define genius for us a little bit too, because I know that you really feel that that's a term that's been hijacked a bit.
Absolutely.
In a way that it's kind of hurt us. So I'm just going to kind of let you go with that little setup in mind.
That's like 17 questions. Yeah, love. Those are Albert Einstein would be proud. So I first started studying, my background is neuroscience and linguistics. So I'm very passionate about language, the development of language, language as it relates to culture and community, but also the science behind how language develops and how language affects, it doesn't just mediate our circumstance, it ends up impacting our identity, our behaviors, and ultimately the behavior of a community. So I've always study the world through those two lenses. And so this book is an embodiment of those two lenses. And so when I started researching what people called genius, whether it was genius organizations or genius individuals across every industry, I spent about a decade and started recognizing, because I too would say when I first started this journey into redefining human potential is really what it is. Advancing human potential. And as an educator, that's our mission. The root word of the word educate means to lead out, not to dump in or not to cram in or to demand on point at 8:45 that this goes in, but to lead out. And in order to do that, you must believe that you are in the presence of genius. And so studying the 2,000-year-old history of the word, it has nothing to do with how we define the word right now. Some DNA anomaly, when the truth is that average is the anomaly, that you can't be average 7 days a week, you know, 24 hours a day, that there's a moment in your day where you yourself are different at some level, and to pinpoint what you're doing or how you're feeling at that moment and to go lean into that and to devote to that is something we don't allow beyond 5 years old. You can explore whatever you want. You believe whatever you want. You know when your body sings or is on fire, your soul is awakened. And when you study the history of individuals that are doing their full life, living their full life as genius, they knew that between the ages of 3 and 6 years old. They knew that's what they were meant to do or who they were meant to be. And then they either got off course or they quit school or, you know, didn't hang around people that didn't believe that, like parents and teachers. So understanding that genius is your birthright. It is the source of your liveliness. It's the root of your resiliency. And tapping into those moments where you are fully alive and you feel different, even if it's for a slight moment. And then really pinpointing, what are you doing? For me, it was teaching. I was in medicine and wasn't alive. I loved learning and I loved understanding the science of the brain, but I never wanted to be a doctor. But to put myself through college, I worked with children. I worked with families and I was alive. That's all I talked about. And so quitting med school and becoming a teacher and no one supporting me in that, I started recognizing I could do what everybody else said, or I could be alive and I could show up every day my full self as a teacher. I don't really care how much money I make or what that looks like on my resume. I would rather be alive. And 31 years later, I'm more alive than ever. So tapping into that and then leaning into that, then it's an extraordinary amount of hours in practice. So that's the first understanding, is that genius is not an anomaly. It's not something that you get and I get. So from a global perspective, what individuals and organizations that make an impact have in common are really three things. They solve problems in ways that no one has yet discovered or communicated.
Right.
They use their individual or collective talent to make an impact in an area that needs to be impacted, or they have a God-given gift that they share freely and fiercely with the world, and the world, when they receive it, doesn't even know they needed that gift. And I think you can watch America's Got Talent, or you can watch a dancing contest, or you can just watch someone who was born to do what they were doing, and you recognize that human beings are a gift to the world. So each and every one of us has done one or more of those things throughout their whole life. They just have never had that marked, and they have never had it named or noticed, certainly not developed or let out. There's very few people. So what happens is we buy into, if you look at where the school system goes wrong, the schools weren't built as incubators of talent. They weren't built to lead out uniqueness. They were built like a prison system to create a society of workers that could handle themselves in industry, that could be cogs in a wheel, and that actually diverting from that was a danger to the economy. And schools never changed from the industrial age. And so we can go into a whole lot of that. But I think that there's a re-envisionment. We talk a lot in education about human talent, about potential, about individuality and customization. But the bottom line is schools are systems of conformity. They're systems of command and control. And that's not going to change for a long time. Leaving it to be our personal responsibility as community members to make sure that we notice and note the genius in our presence. Because well, most
also,
of it
was also set up from the student perspective in terms of
yeah.
Long time ago when I was in elementary school, and I mentioned this on a few programs, where collaborating was cheating, basically.
Well, exactly.
I mean, you know, the idea was yeah. Everyone sat at their desks, they shielded their papers from one another.
Absolutely.
This idea of people working together and having team. And I think that has changed. And I think that is a real positive thing. And I hope it certainly equips people moving forward to be better at it. And I think it will hopefully
help. Genius, as it relates to mattering, that owning your uniqueness, owning the yeah. gifts that you've been given, you were created for significance. Five-year-olds believe they were born to make an impact. And they wake up every day until an adult in their world says, oh, you're not good enough to make that impact, or you're not enough, or you're just that. We weren't born to embrace limitations. That is taught. Average is something that we choose, and maybe not, you know, explicitly, but subtly we're taught to cover up, to hide and hold in our genius because it's not comfortable for the other people around us. And we've got to stop that. This isn't, and if you look at the definition of genius, the ability to solve a problem in a way that it hasn't, the ability to make an impact, the ability to fiercely and freely share your genius with no expectation of reciprocity, none of that's about you. That's all about other people. That's all about finding your essentialness in the world through your contribution. And so that it just flips the idea of what genius is and why it matters. Because the moment we hold back and the moment we hesitate, we stop contributing. We stop contributing in the smallest ways, from eye contact. So when I use the foundation of the movement is built on a single sentence. You are a genius and the world needs your contribution. And I watch saying that line to five-year-olds all the way up to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And about 8 to 9 years old is when I start seeing the first signs of holding back. When I say that to you, like heads go down, we turn this way, like I'm not going to share, you going to share. Like if you say that, I'll say that. And that is absolutely something we should urgently be concerned of, because the moment that our passionate people get quiet, the moment that the most brilliant ideas start being held back, the moment we don't start taking risks with one another, everyone loses, not just the person. Everyone loses and everything is impacted.
What's fascinating about what you're saying is that when you think about all of the stuff we've been talking about with regarding talking and listening and all,
yep,
so much of it comes from a place of insecurity. And 100%. It would appear that the more that we can own our genius, own why we matter,
yes,
the more easily we will be open to trying to see what that is like in others.
Absolutely.
So it reminds me a bit of a story with, Joe Biden tells a story. You may recall when he was elected to the United States Senate, he actually was elected at 29 and turned 30 just before he was sworn in, which actually allowed him to serve as one of the youngest, if not the youngest, people elected to the U.S. Senate. But when he went on Capitol Hill and he's meeting with these Republicans, he was completely I don't know how to put it. He had a really negative attitude about all of his Republican colleagues.
Yeah.
And yet, he couldn't believe how they saw the world and all that.
Yeah.
And Mike Mansfield kind of put his arm around him and said, you know what? There are a lot of people here that don't agree with you. However, I want you to go and meet with each one of these, people, well, men at the time, to really find what it was that their constituents saw in them. What quality, what's their genius is really what he was asking Joe Biden to do. And when he came back, he really started to look at people differently, started to see people differently. And it probably changed forever and gave him, he was definitely one of those people that earned a reputation of the Senate for
Absolutely.
Being able to walk across the aisle because,
Absolutely.
But you bring up such a great point, I think, regarding this whole idea of mattering and understanding and accepting responsibility for our gene and owning it in a way.
Yes.
And that once we can do that, it allows us to do those things for others. In
from a place of moral obligation, I think that's the biggest misnomer,
yep,
is that this ego talking.
Yep.
Mattering is not an ego thing, it's a DNA thing. And once you get that's an essential need, that you're not being humble to anyone by not being of service. And so if you think about this from a community perspective, if you had something, if you knew something, if you could change someone's circumstance, even put a smile on their face, and you withheld that, would you consider yourself a humble, kind, whole person? Absolutely not.
No.
You would consider yourself selfish. So we think that it is... we're not being selfish by blowing our own horn. We're not blowing our own horn. We're alerting our community to how we can be of service to them. And the quicker that we can articulate that, the more efficient our community can be. And that's why I love working with kids, because they don't have ego in this. They see a mission. They see a problem. They see a gap, a heartbreak. And they look around and they don't say, what are they going to do about it? They look around and say collectively, what are we going to do about it? We have enough in this room. And that's where your superpower comes from. It isn't just your own individual capacity. It's knowing that you don't have the pressure of figuring out on your own, that you're surrounded by people equally as powerful as you, but differently unique as you. And it is in that diversity and uniqueness that you have great confidence and power. I am fierce because I know that if everybody around me gives everything that they are, we have nearly enough power in this room to pretty much take on anything. And the reason we're not is because someone in the room, mostly 90% of them, are holding back at some level. And once you get past the enoughness, and I think that's a it's the redistribution of power, because I think it's really easy and it's a cop-out many times. Insecurity is real, but so is our ability to take back our power. We think that other people take away our power. Our greatest enemy is our own voice, is our own fear of insignificance. Mm-hmm. And once we get that out of the way, I can get up on the worst day feeling awful about myself, but understanding my value to other people. And I can jump a mountain. I have that much energy. And it isn't because I think I'm great. It's because I know that I am needed and I bring something of value that someone else may need. I might not have met them and it might not be that day, but I know someday somebody will need what I have and only I can deliver. And there's not a single ounce of ego in that. There's obligation in that.
So you talked about it now, and of course you clearly talk about it in the book with this whole notion of building your dream team.
Absolutely.
How do we do that? How do we surround ourselves with the kind of people that can not only help us own our own genius, but where we can be of service to them as well?
Absolutely. The first step, so there's three sections in the book. And so if you think about the idea that genius exists within and that you're in the presence of genius all of the time, there's three phases of liberating and leading that out. And so the first set of lessons, so there's 30 lessons total. Mm-hmm. The first set of lessons is all of our own work, our deepest, darkest, most difficult work, which is owning and articulating our own genius. And that's a journey that you'll spend. I mean, you can call it personal branding. You can call it whatever you want. With 5-year-olds, I call it owning your genius. And the ability to own it to the level you can articulate it to someone else. Because you can find out what somebody's job is, but I don't want to know your job. I want to know what your genius is, because I can't do anything with your job title. It's irrelevant information to me. So that first set of lessons is really that deep journey of personal branding, if you will. The second phase of lessons is what we call accelerating our potential and the potential of our community by noticing and noting the genius in your presence, by forming and recruiting and nurturing your dream team. You can only do that by being very self-aware. So when there's no ego in it, I always say, genius has no jealousy. So I'm not trying to compete with anybody else except myself. I know what my greatest strengths are. I know what value I bring. I also equally know what I am not good at and have no desire to get better at, because I'm not trying to be everything. I am trying to be the best version of me. So once I know those deficits, then I can start recruiting my dream team. So if you think about a dream team in sports, every single one of the players on a dream team is in their own right genius for whatever they're on. But when you put them together, oh my gosh, you have something out of this world. That's something better than any one of those individuals, as great as they are, could accomplish. That requires embracing your own insecurity, embracing your own ability to say, I don't know, I don't have that, and I'm totally okay with that. It gives me recruiting power, because I'm going to find somebody exactly opposite of me, different than me, because my dream team is the most diverse group of individuals ever. None of them having the same attribute or the same gift as me, because we're not going to be able to do as much. And because I'm not competing with them, because I'm not, taken aback because I think they're better. They're different, and I'm glad they're different. So the diversity of your dream team, I don't just mean diversity like I've got 4 boys on it, 3 girls on it. Diversity of thought, diversity of experience, diversity of perspective, diversity of insight, and actually recruiting people on your dream team that don't like you, that don't think you're great, that would absolutely torpedo any idea that you had, that takes a lot of self-awareness and a lot of conviction and calmness about who you are, never wavering in that. Because I'm not trying to be like them. I'm trying to use their power. And that's where your dream team becomes unstoppable, where a small group of people, like Margaret Mead said, a small group of passionate people can change the world. but it's got to be the right combination of those people. And I think we have been taught, we've been educated to get along with people that are like us. We've been educated to be drawn to form communities around people that are like us, because it's a lot easier. So when we talk about collaboration, I don't think very many people have actually truly collaborated. I think they've cooperated. I think they have done things in small groups together. But the foundation of collaboration is conflict. There must be conflict at any level, because nobody's getting their way, because you're reaching and doing something that you didn't even imagine doing because you weren't capable of it on your own. And so it's a complicated, complex process that we should start guiding people through, because it's not just about getting a group of people. It's about getting the right combination of people. So it really can be a force that makes all of you not only the best version of yourselves, but all of you, the room, accomplish more than any of you could by working on your own independent genius. And then the third layer of the book is, how do you take collective action with that? How do you truly, with the most diverse group of individuals, leverage collective genius? And I think that's why we're not solving problems. It's not because we don't have enough talent. It's not because there's a talent shortage. It's not because we don't have enough money or resources, which I know a million people would disagree. Our issues are not because we have lack of money. It's because we have lack of the ability to truly leverage collective genius. Because to do that, you can have no ego. You can have no ulterior motive. You can have no intention that is any less than doing something epically beyond what you were individually incapable of doing. And that's a process. Mm-hmm. And the only people I've actually seen do it with ease are young kids. I've never seen innovation happen at the velocity of watching a room of young people within an hour let go of every insecurity and every element of ego and competition and look at the problem and say, what are we going to do to solve it? And then do it just like that. And it's like a miracle, watching a miracle.
Well, that's what yeah. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's so interesting. So there's two things that come to mind before we wrap up. One is, some of the advice that I think a lot of us were given growing up is, when you have conversations with people, at all costs, avoid the topics of religion and politics. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, because it's based on the premise that it challenges someone's view, that you're trying
absolutely
to mind, that you're trying to do all of these kinds of things that should be the opposite, and why we are so poorly trained at being able to dialogue about anything. If we were in fact told, by all means, talk about religion and politics and learn as much as you can about exactly where they come from, what their views are, and how this looks like, I think it would be a different world if that piece of advice were turned on its head, for people going forward. But I also think that, to your point, I think the answer is to get us working together, seeing one another, listening for understanding, and doing these kinds of things is not easy, and it's going to be a process. But it will be, like much of what you talked about, it's like, how can I matter in making the world just a little better? So what would be your advice for people like me, or anyone who fancies themselves a leader on any level, to model behavior that can be helpful to others?
I'm going to give you, I think, two pieces, and then end with an actual vision of hope, because this world that you're talking about, this world that we think is impossible, I'm living in that world every day. There are almost 1 million students in Choose to Matter, and they have made a public proclamation. I think 3 years ago, I wrote a manifesto for the movement, and we had 875,000 kids sign it. And every day, they come to school and say, I have a moral obligation to use my genius to leave the world better off than I found it. And they define their world. It could be three people or the globe.
Sure.
And the fiercest ones among them, the fiercest change makers that are actually moving forward, changing laws, launching enterprises, are between 6 and 11 years old. So we have a real chance to not only support what they do, but to use them as models. So I think the first piece of advice is going to sound really flippant and cliche, but it isn't. I mean it seriously. My favorite definition of genius, it was a definition in 1632 by a guy named Alex Hewley or something like that. And it said the genius is the ability to carry the spirit of childhood through adulthood. Mm. So with fierceness, not cliche, get back to a space and a place that reminds you of your five-year-old self. And that's what Genius Matters is. It's really a path, a systematic path to get us individually and collectively back to the spirit of who we were when we were five. Not just how we believed in ourselves, but how we treated other people around us. Sit in a sandbox with five-year-olds. It doesn't matter what place or what place, everyone is your friend. There's no judgments. We learn hatred and judgment and all of the things that make our world, these are learned behaviors. So we can unlearn them, but you have to go back to the time where those behaviors didn't exist. And secondly, and I say this because I'm grateful that I get to give the book away free for at least another 4 or 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. Even though Genius Matters was shaped for conversations for teachers to have with kids, these are lessons that I've been taught. I am very blessed to be surrounded by change makers, by individuals like Seth Godin and Gary Vaynerchuk and you, Leo, and a whole network of individuals that are making an impact in the world. And these are the collections of conversations I've had either with them or because of them. And they're written down because I wish somebody would given me a manual and reminded me that I have the capacity to use my genius in great ways and that I have an obligation to do that. And so I think every one of the lessons in some way can spark a conversation in your context, whether you are a CEO of a company or you're an entrepreneur or you're a mom or a dad, or you just want to be a better citizen. I really believe that these are the lessons of citizenship in what will be the 22nd and 3rd and 4th and 5th century. And then we have to get back to that. So I think reminding yourself that being childlike is not being childish, that it is an urgent path to get us back to that moment where we were fierce, where we were confident, where we showed up every day full, and try to go backwards to when we started losing that. And the lessons are then there to build that back up, to build our curiosity, to build our passion, to build our confidence. And it's, I think the greatest, I was at a technology conference and was asked, what's the most next disruptive force on the web? Humanity. Humanity. It's always been the force. Technology's never changed lives in the world. Humans have done that. People do that. But people that believe that the world wasn't created by anyone better or smarter or wiser or richer than them, and they step up every day to create the world they believe they deserve to live in. And try to find your tribe. Try to find not only people that think differently, that push boundaries, but then start recruiting for your dream team. Start recruiting for people different than you, that will challenge you, that will push you, that will make you not remain comfortable. I think people think being brave is about doing grand things, or changing the world is about doing grand things. The opposite of courage is comfortability. And so you can be courageous or you can be comfortable. And you've got to be around people that will not allow you to be comfortable. And you will astound yourself. You should be uncomfortable. And having conversations about things that are uncomfortable is exactly what we need to do. Ignoring them and taking the easy way out isn't going to change it. And there's no one else out there. You can't say, well, they need to change that. You are the they. You matter. You are the they. We are the they. And the world's waiting for us. And we need to step up and do it for ourselves, but also do it for this next generation of kids so that when we leave, that they will take over from that place of leadership and hope and possibility.
Well, Angela Myers, thank you so, so much. I mean, it's not only was it an inspiring message, but I know, of course, you know, everything you shared, let me just say, certainly mattered a whole lot to our audience and to Year of the Peer this year. But just before we go, though, I do want you to be able to share with people, because you've shared so much with us today and given us so many gifts, where they can learn more about you and more about your work.
So you will laugh at this. This is part of showing up when you don't feel like it. So my website, I won't say it got hacked. There was a challenge with it, and I lost 2,700 blog posts and all my SEO. Wow. And so the Used to Matter website and my personal website all went down with everything.
I feel the physical pain of that, right? Yes. Oh my God.
A massive amount of... But I'm still smiling because every single thing literally has gone wrong. I funded Choose to Matter for 4 years on my own and been through people that weren't part of my dream team and partners that I thought were partners and have failed so many times I can't even tell you. And the pain's excruciating. But I wake up every day because I believe so deeply. This is not an ideology. This is biology. And biology doesn't change. As quick as technology changes, human beings don't. And we need to know we matter. And until my last breath, I'm gonna make that my mission, website or not website. So right now, the best way to get a hold of me is not via my website, which is painful, but probably via Twitter or Facebook. You can email me at angelamyers@gmail.com. Like, I can't tell you to search the book right now because I don't even know if it's restored in search yet. And if you know any, if your genius is website development or your genius is helping people from a devastating situation, your genius is needed. I have hope. And this message is revolutionary. And anything that you, any idea you have, any genius that I haven't thought of yet, any way that we can get this message to be, not spread, but to be taken seriously. These two words, you matter, to be taken as seriously as five-year-olds, as life and death for many people. I am absolutely open to adding to my dream team. So I can't wait to see what your community thinks. I can't wait to learn more about their genius. And I just can't wait to see where the conversation takes us.
Well, it is crushing to think that you lost that much content. I will only say this, that if it gives you some comfort, that think about the countless people who have been exposed to your ideas and insights and thoughts and have taken those forward. That's pretty gratifying and pretty exciting. And there's so much more to do. So thank you again for being on the program. We just loved having you.
I'm grateful for you, Leo. I'm so grateful to have this hour with you. I probably talked way too much. Being quiet is not my genius. But I mean this seriously. I want to keep the conversation going. I don't want to be just a guest on your show. And this isn't about inspiration. This is about action. So if nothing else that I hope this inspires, I hope it inspires some action. And I think the first step is, joining me, joining force, letting me know how I can help you. How this message might serve your community, and then we'll stay connected. And I'm going to build back whatever I need to build back up, and I'll be back up and running, but I'm not quitting. Nothing. I'm not quitting no matter what. I'm not quitting.
Well, as long as you agree to be a member of my dream team, then that would be really wonderful. All right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you have a wonderful day. Thank you everybody so much. And I mean this with all my heart. You matter. No hesitating, no holding back. I will stick five-year-olds on you. If you think you're going to hold back in front of them, good luck with that. So, yes.
You have a great day. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about Peer Advantage, to submit questions to Leo and our guest, and to subscribe to the Year of the Peer podcast, please visit us at leobattari.com. That's L-E-O BOTTARY.com. This podcast is produced by me, Randy Cantrell. Hosted, of course, by Leo Batari. Music provided by Kevin McLeod, Vibe Ace. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.